The fact that we're still here post 21st of December 2012. I wonder how many different predictions now have been proven wrong. Maybe there's someone out there keeping tabs on that. Anyway, Christmas is coming up, and I hope you're taking some time off, maybe listening to some Red Ice Radio while you're doing other things, or maybe at least taking a break from this bizarre and hectic period where many people, they usually protest it in some way, but they still fall in line and copy the behavior of everyone else. Because it's just the thing you do. Well, if nothing else, I at least hope that you're enjoying it and feel that it's all worth it. Well, today we are going to spend some time with Patrick Flanagan. He's an American author and holds several patents as an inventor. Flanagan has written books focused on Egyptian sacred geometry and pyramidology. He actively continues his activities as scientist, inventor, and philanthropist, promoting the really new science and new approaches to human healing. In the first hour, Flanagan tells his story as a child prodigy, his inventions and the projects he worked on for the U.S. government. He also talks about his experience with Andrea Puharich, who was involved in locating so-called brilliant children for the Star Child Project. Dr. Patrick Flanagan invented the Neurophone in 1958. It's an electronic nervous system excitation device that transmits sound through the skin directly to the brain, for which he received a U.S. patent. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Patrick. Glad to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time off to talk about yourself and your work today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really good. I also want to say thanks to Mark Hosa for helping us to get in contact with you, Patrick, as well. So it's going to be really great. I've been familiar with your work for many years. Heard you in the early 2000s on previous interviews talking about some of your inventions, the Neurophone, the Hansa Water, a lot of different things you've been involved in, Patrick. And as far as I understand it, also the older you've gotten, the more kind of has come to you throughout the years of what you've been involved in. I heard previously you actually talked about Andrea Puharich and the Star Child Project. Is that where kind of things began for you, or should we go back earlier if we want to talk about all of this from the beginning, Patrick?
Well, yeah, sure. It actually started when I was 8 years old. When I was a baby, I was looking at my toes and I remember very, very clearly thinking that it's going to take me so long to grow up this body, and I hate growing up baby bodies. And so by the time I was 8, I was a general class ham radio operator and designing and building all of my own electronic equipment. And I had a series of nightmares when I was that age, in which I was told that the fate of the world depended on my knowledge. And it was a recurring nightmare that went on night after night after night, and the only way to make the nightmare go away was to read everything I could read, to learn everything I could learn. So I became a prolific reader, and by the time I was 14 years old, I was reading at 14,500 words a minute with 95% comprehension. I pretty much got a photographic memory. And or eidetic memory, and the result of that is that I accumulated a vast amount of knowledge from reading thousands of books. And when I was 11 years old or 12 years old, I moved from Montana. My father was an oil scout with Shell Oil Company, and we moved every 3 months when I was a child.
Oh, wow.
Different town.
Yeah.
And we moved to Houston, Texas, from Montana, and they said in that there's a science fair coming up, an all-city science fair for all grades, all the way through college. And if anyone had a science fair project, they should, build it up and prepare for the science fair. So I had this idea for a missile launch detection system that would detect when ICBMs were launched. Back then, they were doing all this research on intercontinental ballistic missiles. And also on, they were doing above ground atomic testing. And so I developed a device that would detect every time a missile was launched anywhere in the world and every time an atomic bomb test was run, and I could pinpoint its location and the exact moment that it occurred. And so I entered the science fair, and I had a list of everything I had detected over a period of about a year. I'd been doing this for a long time. And I won the science fair, the entire fair, overall categories. And I was in seventh grade, and I went to class the following Monday morning, and the principal came on the loudspeaker, and he said, will Patrick Flanagan come to my office immediately? The Pentagon is on the telephone. So I went to his office and talked to a five-star general at the Pentagon, and they sent a team of scientists from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, about 12, down to Houston, and they took my invention away from me and made my father and sign an agreement that it was under secrecy and that if I talked to anyone about it outside of authorized U.S. government representatives, that I could be charged with treason. And
wow.
And so that was my beginning of my career with the U.S. government.
Off to a good start then, huh?
And then I was hired by Pentagon Think Tank, run by William O. Davis, who was former head of the Office of Scientific Research of the Pentagon. It was a separate think tank under contract with the Pentagon. And I was hired by them, and I used to go to their place in I lived in Houston, but I used to go up to Stamford, Connecticut, and work in the summers at the Pentagon think tank. And then from there, I started working for the U.S. Navy Naval Ordnance Test Station out of China Lake, California, doing dolphin research, talking to dolphins. And we were developing a man-dolphin language translator that translates human speech and the dolphin whistles, very complex whistles. And the dolphins, then when they would repeat the complex whistles, it would come out of the translator as English. And so we were working on creating a man-dolphin language. And the goal of that project was to create a 500-word vocabulary. Because there are 500 words in any language that if you know them, you can speak fluently to any native, and then they can teach you other words and you can expand your vocabulary and, expand your conversation. And I did that in my early 20s. I worked for NASA also on the Gemini space projects, on the computers that ran the Gemini space projects for a year, before I went to work for Naval Ordnance Test Station. And so I've had a career with that. But when I was in my late 20s, I stopped all government work and went off on my own and, built my own businesses and stopped doing, that kind of work.
interesting. A lot of things to talk about just there, of course. If we back up a little bit, how, I mean, nuclear detection, either if a missile is launched somewhere in the world or if a nuclear bomb goes off anywhere, how did this technology work? How did you come up with this?
Well, let's start with a missile. When a missile is fired, it produces a plasma, superheated gas plasma from the rocket coming off the tail of the missile. And this goes up in the sky, and it's a super dense, high energy electrical plasma, ionized. And that plasma is like a vertical antenna, like a radio vertical antenna. And it's radiating all the frequencies of the ionized gases that were made up of the propellant from the rocket. And so the result of that is that I was able to detect, using essentially a loop antenna, I was able to detect and identify the frequencies, because a missile, when it's launched, would have very characteristic frequencies depending on the propellant use and a particular kind of sound in the audio, actually. And these signals travel around the world with less than a 3% decrease in amplitude at those wavelengths. And so you can easily radio direction find and locate where, you know, generally where the location of the launch was. And the same thing with an atomic bomb. When an atomic bomb goes off, it produces a huge ionized plasma going way up into the atmosphere. But it has a different characteristic than the ICBM from the fuel, because it's an atomic explosion. And so that particular plasma produces a different frequencies and a different characteristic, which is easily identifiable. And so that's what I did. And they took it away, and they told me I wanted to be an astronaut. That was my goal in life, to be an astronaut. And they told me they'd make me an astronaut. Of course, that never happened.
Right.
But so anyway, that's what got the attention of the government.
Do you know how the Pentagon kind of got nose of your science project?
Well, when I won the science fair, it went off on the Associated Press wire services, and it was on the front page of hundreds and hundreds of papers clear across America.
Right.
The story, and so that's how they got it.
And you could build all this with what you had, obviously, at your disposal at the time as a young kid.
I built it with $5 in parts.
You're kidding.
No, and in a newspaper article, it said that if I had $20, I could have built a much better one.
So, no different or difficult parts, in other words? All of this was things you could pick together? And again, I mean, I do want to get into how you came up with this and how this came to you.
Well, because of the vast knowledge that I had accumulated by then, I was especially interested in ionized plasmas, the electrical plasmas, ionized gas plasmas. And I knew that ionized gas plasmas emitted frequencies, you know, emitted energy, mm-hmm. depending on their content. And one of my Pentagon handlers told me, because of my knowledge across multiple fields of science and multiple fields, period, that I was able to find threads or connections between sciences that other people couldn't find, because most scientists specialize in a very narrow field, and they only know that narrow band of knowledge that they're focusing on, and don't know that someone in another field of science may be doing work of a similar nature on something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but me, with the knowledge I have, I can put things together. In other words, find connections that no one else can find. And so my Pentagon handler said that I should call myself an encyclopedic synthesis, because I can, with encyclopedic knowledge, I can synthesize things that no one else would dream of or know of or think of.
I see. Now, what did you, what were some of the things that you did, or rather maybe came up with at the Pentagon later, at this think tank that you mentioned?
Well, we were working on a number of things. I worked with Dr. Henri Kwanda, who is known as the father of fluid dynamics, and he had 500 patents on fluid dynamics and is known for the Kwanda effect, which is used in the design and building of every single airplane on Earth. And it's his formulas and techniques. And Dr. Kwanda built a torpedo that would travel underwater. It created a vacuum in front of the torpedo and therefore produced no weight. And his torpedo would go underwater at over 100 miles an hour, without making any sound, or, it would just slip through the water.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on that with him, and we had a circular tank with an arm and a captive torpedo on it, and we'd make that thing go around at 100 miles an hour. Underwater, and without creating the torpedo itself didn't create a ripple on the water. It was very profound. And it was so far advanced, interestingly enough, that the Navy scientists, because they couldn't explain how it worked, and they actually didn't implement it, which is very interesting. I worked on some things I can't talk about, back then.
Mm-hmm.
We also did some research on my neurophone invention.
Yeah.
Anyway, it only was for a couple of summers.
Sure. How did you feel working for the Pentagon at the time?
Well, I thought it was okay. You know, I wasn't building weapons, except, you know, the torpedo thing could have been a weapon, but,
sure. Yeah.
They didn't get into it. And I worked for Aberdeen Proving Grounds on a couple of ideas for secret communications during Vietnam. And also did research for some other agencies. I received an award when I was 17 years old, called the Gold Plate Award, and for my invention of the neurophone. And this was an award at Del Webb's Ocean House in San Diego. And the Gold Plate Award is still around. Apparently, they're still giving them. But also receiving the same award with me, in other words, on an equal level with me, was Admiral Red Rayburn, who was director in charge of the CIA, and he was getting his award for developing the Polaris submarine, and also receiving the same award at the time was Edward Teller for developing the atomic bomb, and also receiving the same award was Murray Gell-Mann,
mm-hmm.
who had done work with viruses and Nobel Prize winner. And so we were all sitting at the same table getting the same award, and Admiral Rayburn offered me a scholarship. He said that the CIA would put me in any college or any university in the world for as long as I wanted.
Mm.
And give me, back in the 1960s, a $165,000 a year allowance in addition to paying for the college. and that I could learn as much as I wanted and get as many degrees as I wanted, and that all I had to do when I was done is work for the CIA for 5 years, and then I could go on and do whatever I wanted to do with my life. And I talked around, and almost everyone I talked to said they won't let you go after 5 years. They'll never let you go. And at the time, I was making more money than my father was when I was 17. And so I didn't have money needs, so I declined the offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Red Rayburn said, well, son, how about this? From now on, we can do favors for each other. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, he said, if government or anybody gives you a problem, you call me up and I'll take care of it, or whatever the problem is. And he said, and if we have any problems, we'll call you up and tell you what we think you can do about it. And then, you do that. And it's a exchange of favors, no money, just favors. And so I agreed to that. And, he said, anytime you want to talk to me, just call up the CIA. He later went on and, the next year went on and became director in charge of the National Security Agency. But he said, always call the CIA. So I called the CIA with a problem once, and the guy answered the phone, and I said, I was told by Admiral Red Rayburn that I could leave a message for him here, and the guy said, never heard of him. And I said, he was director in charge of the CIA. And the guy said, still never heard of him. I said, well, he said I could leave a message for him, and he'd call me back in 24 hours. And the guy said, you can leave a message here for anyone you want. He says, we just won't guarantee that they'll call you back. And I said, okay. So I left a message, and he called me back, and that was the beginning of our favors program. And I developed a high security encryption system for them that could not be decoded, voice encryption, that could not be decoded by anyone. And in return for the favor he did for me. And we stayed in touch for years until he died.
Hmm. Now, if we talk a little bit about your Dolphin to English translation as well. You worked with John Lilly on that, as far as I understand. Was that ever successful then, that project?
John Lilly had his own contract with the Navy. He was not part of our contract.
Okay.
We were friends, and John Lilly was doing other things, but we had three partners in the company, and then other investors. Our company was called Listening Incorporated, and we were located in Boston, Arlington, Massachusetts, and we would build electronic equipment, and then we had dolphins. We had offices in Sea Life Park on Oahu in Hawaii, and we had a small island called Coconut Island off the coast. It was a horseshoe-shaped island with a really nice little natural bay, and we put a couple of sea fences to block the bay, and we had a houseboat, and we had two dolphins that we were training and working with, and once in a while, we'd open up the sea fence, and the dolphins would go out and perform exercises that we trained them to do. And then they'd, come back at night. And so that went on for a number of years until my partner, Dwight Wayne Bateau, who was an information theory specialist, he had taught at Harvard, and when we were doing the project, he was working with Tufts University. I also worked at Tufts University at the time, in addition to Listening Incorporated. And basically, one day he'd go swimming when he was in Hawaii. He'd go swimming every morning before he went to work on a particular cove. And that morning he went swimming and he basically drowned in 3 feet of water. And no one could figure out why he drowned, and we never found out whether it was foul play or whatever. I was in my 20s, and Steve Moser, the other partner, was in his 20s. And the Navy said that they were canceling our contract. And we said we could continue the work. But he said, the Navy said, no, we don't think you can do it. And they canceled the contract, and then they put the results of our work under secrecy for 75 years. And they're going to release the secrecy on it in about 2025.
So we don't know at this stage if, because of the project and work you did partially, then actually we come any closer to realizing what the dolphins have to say.
Yeah. Well, we developed a 35-word vocabulary up to that point.
Okay.
And, and we had blown away several of the Skinner, who is the world's considered the world's foremost authority on animal intelligence.
You're talking about B.F. Skinner or?
B.F. Skinner, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
He was a consultant for the project, and he said that, for example, if you gave a dolphin, let's say, you had a routine and you said to the dolphin, swim out, touch a ball, swim through a hoop, and then come back. And so halfway through the, let's say partway through after the dolphin got the instructions, if you were to change the instructions and say, no, swim through the hoop first, touch the ball, and then come back, that a dolphin couldn't do it, that he'd have to, that it would confuse him and he wouldn't do anything because they have no intelligence and only stimulus response. And basically early on we learned that we could tell the dolphins that we could change their direction mid-course and they'd follow through just fine, showing that they do, you know, have thinking ability. They're not just stimulus response, let's say a German Shepherd might be. So dolphins are, their temporal lobes of their brains, we're considered to be more intelligent than monkeys because our temporal lobes and our brains are much larger than those of a monkey. But if you follow the same logic, the temporal lobes of the dolphins are, these are abstract thinking lobes, you know. And the temporal lobes of the dolphin are much larger than ours are, and of whales also. And so if you use that same logic, you would say that whales and dolphins are way more intelligent than we are. Now, the interesting thing about dolphins is that they're non-territorial. That is, they will allow any animal to enter their territory. All other animals and fish and birds and so forth throughout the world, throughout nature, mark off their territory, and they get quite irritated when other animals or birds or, you know, come into their territory and drive them away. Dolphins allow any thing to come into their territory as long as it's non-aggressive, and will drive out aggressors. And dolphins also babysit for each other's young. Like if a father and mother want to go out and go hunting and fishing together, why another dolphin will take care of the young, babysit them. And the other thing is that other animals have you know, sex only when they're in season, you know, when their hormones are at a certain level where they can conceive. And dolphins pretty much have sex 24 hours a day for pleasure. So they're way different than other animals, other mammals.
I mean, I've heard, Patrick, for years from, I guess we can call it the New Age community, all kinds of rumors about dolphins that they're not even native to the planet and all kinds of stuff. And I mean, you can comment on that as well if you want to. But I know that the Pentagon have been working with dolphins in different ways, trying to kind of help them to clear mines in the water. And, I mean, they have had all these kinds of weird fringe projects. This, I think, actually particularly was with sharks, though, but they had plans of actually arming sharks with chemical implants and even cameras, and that might have extended to dolphins as well, depending on how well that actually developed. But anything of that you want to comment on?
Well, I know one thing is that dolphins can see better with sound than we can with our eyes. In other words, their sound vision is better than 20/20. And so they can identify objects and things from great distances just using sound waves, sonar. And their eyes are way better than our eyes. And so they have fantastic abilities. And one of the things is that their hearing is so good that we train dolphins to every shipbuilder in the world has their own formula for making their ship hulls, you know, their sure. own particular ship hull steel formula. And what we did is we got steel from every ship manufacturer in the world, put the steel in the water, and the dolphin would ping the metal with its sound waves and listen to the return. And then the dolphins could identify with 100% accuracy each one. And so then we set up a switchboard underwater in Vietnam Harbor. And with all the different ship manufacturers, and no matter what flag a ship was flying, in other words, you could have a Russian ship flying a Panamanian flag, the dolphins would check out the ships, and then they'd go push the button identifying where the ship was manufactured, so we'd know what its true origins were.
Sure. Interesting. If we talk about, or if you want to talk about Puharich a little bit more, I've always been interested in his work, both in the occult and some of the alleged things that he was involved in. Is there anything more you can say about him? And again, the Star Child project that I've heard you mentioned elsewhere.
Well, it turns out that, I invented the Neurophone when I was 13 years old and wrote my own patent application and applied, you know, to the patent office on the patent. And it turns out that Puharich had invented a Neurophone, but he, in the end, we found out that he had applied for a patent 6 months after I applied for my patent. Mm-hmm. So I got the first patent. But meanwhile, whenever you're dealing before your patent is issued, back then, they said you're not supposed to tell other inventors when you applied for your patent because they might try to predate their research notes and things like that before when you applied for your patent or before you to try to claim that they were the original inventor.
Right.
So Puharich contacted me. I was on the Gary Moore show, I've Got a Secret, back in 1962. And Bess Meyerson, the movie actress, was on the show in 1962. You know, women pretty much covered their whole bodies from head to toe when they dressed. But on the show, Bess Meyerson had a dress that had a V-cut all the way back on her back. Her entire back was exposed all the way down to the, you know, right below her waist. And the panel was supposed to guess what I was doing to her. And I took the Neurophone, which is this electronic hearing device, and I put the electrodes on the base of her spine. And she was hearing a poem recorded by Andy Griffin. And the poem was, there was a little girl with a little curl in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very good. But when she was bad, she was awesome. And so Bess Meyerson was listening to this poem, this little saying, through the Neurophone. And the panel was supposed to guess what I'm doing to her. Mm-hmm. And they had all kinds of guesses, and no one really got it. And so after that show, Andrea Puharich invited my mother and I to the 21 Club for lunch. And then he starts grilling me about the Neurophone, and when I invented it, when I applied for a patent and so forth, and I wouldn't answer him. And over the years, we became, we were friends and enemies at the same time, and because of the patent situation. And I made a special Neurophone for the U.S. government and for Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and Puharich tried to keep me from getting paid for it, $100,000 contract back then, and tried to keep me from being paid by stating that I stole the Neurophone from him. And neither his patent nor my patent had issued at that time, but they tended to believe him because I was just a kid and he's an adult medical doctor and all these things. But finally I was able, the patent came out.
Mm-hmm.
My patent came out, and I was able to prove that I was the original inventor, and I got my money. And, in the meantime, later on, a friend of mine was visiting Puharich not too long before he died. He was on the J.R. Reynolds tobacco plantation in a house that he was given to live in. And a friend of mine was visiting, another scientist friend was visiting Puharich, and he said, "You work for the company, don't you? And you've always worked for the company," because it was always rumored that Puharich worked for the CIA and as a psychiatrist. And basically he said, "Well, come downstairs and I'll show you." And there was a walk-in safe, very large safe that you could open the door and walk in. And they walked into the safe, and there was a book that said Star Child Project. And Puharich opened the book, and it was all handwritten names. And there were 10 names on the first page. And my name was right at the top of the thing. And my friend's name was about eight down. And Puharich said that his job was to locate advanced children, and control their lives, or figure out a way, neutralize them, or figure out a way to get them to work for the government, because they didn't want them falling into the hands of the enemies, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
being out there uncontrolled. And and he told who is now my friend at the time, "Do you know Patrick Flanagan?" And my friend said, "No, but I read an article about him in Life magazine when that came out." And Gart said, "Well, you need to get to know him. You're a lot alike." And later on, we became friends. And so I had a lot of intrigue in my life. I've had a lot of skullduggery and interference when I was younger, from, you know, the authorities and so forth. And that's all pretty much disappeared by now.
Hmm. So Pukharic tried to get his hands, so to speak, on these children for the CIA, basically.
Yeah, and identify them, and then when I was in school, they told my parents I was a problem child and that advanced, and that they had special psychiatrists who would work with me and help me, and because I was hyperactive, ADHD, and these psychiatrists were government psychiatrists, some of them working, and they gave me drugs and hypnosis and all kinds of things. So that's something I had a lot of memories that were suppressed that I only remembered 1 year ago at the age of 67.
Is there any of that you'd like to talk about?
Not really.
Okay. Was it unpleasant, most of it, or?
Wow.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. No. Well, we could look at the bigger picture here. Then, is this how the Pentagon, the DOD, MIT, you know, Boston Dynamics, there's a lot of different research facilities, universities tied to the military around the United States. Is this, in your view, how they get most of their ideas? By, well, more or less taking it from other talented people who are within the creative flow, creative force, so to speak?
Well, sure. I'm sure they get a lot of their ideas that way. I was blocked, like, you know, my neurophone, my first neurophone patent came out, and then I applied for a second one, and it was put under secrecy. The government said that it had potential military uses, and they put it under secrecy, and I couldn't do anything with it for years. And that's one of the things that I asked Red Rayburn for help on, and he got it out of secrecy, which allowed the patent to be issued. But what he didn't say is that I would be free to put it on the market. Because for years, when I was trying to build neurophones and put them on the market, odd things would happen. And I'd be blocked at every turn, and fires and different things. And I later found out that was all part of the background. They said that he got the patent released from secrecy, but it didn't mean that they were going to let me put it on the market. It took me years to get the first neurophone on the market.
Well, I mean, in the next segment, I want to talk more about some of the fringe aspects of this, how it can be used for mind control and other things like that. But why don't we talk about what the neurophone actually is and how it works first?
Okay, well, the original neurophone is a 40 kilohertz, 40,000 cycle per second. Our normal hearing range when we're babies might go up to, from low frequencies up to 20 kilohertz, but adults generally can't hear higher than maybe 12 kilohertz, 12,000 cycles. And so 40,000 cycles is way above human hearing, and it's in the low end of the radio band. And so the original neurophone was a 40 kilohertz amplitude modulated radio transmitter that produced 3,000 volts on the output. And I had a couple of metal plates, copper plates, and I would put insulator, Mylar insulator, over the plates. And what you do is you put these plates on the head, and you don't get any electric shock because they're insulated. but it's got 3,000 volts at 40 kilohertz, and then amplitude modulated, which is a way of putting audio into the, you know, like an AM radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear the sound very clearly inside your head. And we tested it with some very profound deaf people, and they were able to hear the modulation. Most of the totally deaf, profoundly deaf people could hear with it. And I applied for the patent on it, and the patent office wouldn't believe it worked, and they refused to issue a patent and closed the case on it, closed the file. And so when I was about 19 years old, I had enough money now to afford a lawyer, to hire a lawyer. So I flew to Washington, D.C. to the patent office with a model of the Neurophone, which is unheard of. Nobody brings, you know, models of their inventions to the patent office. But they told us that they had a deaf employee of the patent office who had heard but was stone deaf for 15 years. And they said that if I could make him hear with my invention, that they would reopen the file, never been done before, that they would reopen the file with the original filing date, and they would issue my patent.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into a room, and they brought this this guy in that was deaf, hadn't heard anything, not a sound for 15 years. And his favorite music was opera and Maria Callas. And so we brought a 78 RPM record player with the Maria Callas album. And we hooked it up to the Neurophone. We put the Neurophone on his head, and he heard for the first time in 15 years, and he just broke down in tears, crying and crying and crying. And pretty soon the entire patent office was crying. Everybody, you know, Kleenexes all around. And so they reopened the file and gave me my original patent. That's how I got the first patent. And and then, you know, that's when the intrigue started. Yeah.
Would you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Well, the government thinks that, rightly so, that you could use distant hearing. You can take a microwave transmitter and modulate it with voice a certain way, aim it at a person's head, and it'll sound like a voice inside their head, you know.
Right.
You can say this is God, or you can take their own voice, record their own voice, and then play it back to them, and they'll think it's their own self-thinking things. You know, pretty much as a mind-control device, you can make the audio level low, so that it's a subliminal kind of suggestion.
Let me ask you this before you carry on here, Patrick. I read a while back that a similar technique was used, and this is with the so-called L-Rod, device, or even the corporation is L-Rod. It's some sort of long-range acoustic device, and this is they actually emit sound in a 30-degree beam at about 2.5 kilohertz. It's microwaves, you know, coming out. Is this similar, or is it completely different?
No, that's similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you know if this is something that was picked up by what you did originally? Do you think, or could maybe they just came up with this on their own? Because again, it's used in the same way. I know that they're broadcasting voices with these L-Rod devices, basically.
Well, I think that once they determine, once I showed them that you could make people hear with radio waves, with the ultrasonics that they picked up on it and did their own research.
Mm. Yeah.
Guy, a microwave engineer by the name of Fry, was one of the first people to notice that if you that some people could hear pulsed microwaves, if they were pulsed in the audio range, that people could hear a buzzing in their head.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's a matter of figuring out how to turn the audio into a format. Because with microwaves, it can't be amplitude modulation. It's got to be pulse modulation. And my second patent that was put under secrecy was a way of turning audio into pulse modulation that sounds exactly the same as ordinary sound, but it's pulse modulation and doesn't require conversion. In other words, the pulse modulation itself, when received by the person, sounds like ordinary audio, whereas a lot of pulse modulation used in the electronics, you know, and in computers has to be converted back into, you know, audio before it can be understood.
Mm-hmm.
What I was a way of doing it so that the pulse modulation itself was crystal clear.
Oh, interesting. Now, we're going to break here in a little bit. Again, I want to carry on with you in the next segment, talk more about this, how it's been implemented. I remember a story a couple of years ago, I think it was from 2007, if I remember correctly as well. They talked about how this was used in an ad campaign for a TV show, pretty much for a paranormal TV show. And when people basically walked into this beam, they could hear voices, and some of them, you know, it was kind of creepy. They didn't know if it was, is it from inside my own head or where is this coming from kind of thing. So it can be used in different settings and in different ways. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who have ideas about how this could be implemented and used in other ways. But before we take a break, Patrick, why don't we talk a little bit more about your website, some of the things you have available there, because you've obviously carried on your scientific and technological knowledge in many other areas. You produce many different things, but the Neurophone, for example, is actually something you sell today on your website, correct?
Well, we're starting to sell them again. We had a problem with manufacturing, and right now they're being manufactured in Germany, and we expect them in any moment. We've had a we've had a drought of Neurophones for the last couple of years, but they're coming back in again. I also, when I worked for the Pentagon, working with Dr. Kawanda, his pet study was water. And, you know, the human body is 70% water. And when we're born, we're 90% water. And the brain is 90% water. And Dr. Kawanda said that water is the most important nutrient we put in our body, and not all water is equal. And he had traveled to Hunza Land, where people were at that time virtually cancer-free, disease-free, lived to be over 100 years old, could father children, 80, 90 years old. And he studied their water versus other water and discovered that Hunza water had a special property. And when I was 17, he turned all of his 60 years of research over to me. And I began my own. He didn't know the answer as to how it worked. And so I spent a number of years, 20 years, researching it myself, and I discovered this secret of Hunza water. And my website and the products I sell, most of the products there, are based on my discovery of the secret of Hunza water and how to utilize that for health and longevity.
Exactly, really good. The website is phisciences.com. That's phisciences.com, and there's a lot of different things on there, of course. You can check out a lot of research and interesting material about some of the things we've been talking about here, and hope to get into some more of that in the second, of course. Anything else you want to say about the website, Patrick, before we take a break?
Yeah, there are all of our papers were published in scientific journals, including the Journal of Free Radical in Biology and Medicine, which is the number one free radical publishing journal in the world. And we've shown that we can extend cell life by at least four times beyond what's called the normal Hayflick limit, which is means that most of us die when we reach our cells begin dying when we reach about 60 because the cells can't divide anymore. And now we know about telomeres, so our product apparently increases the length of telomeres because we're able to multiply that by at least four and a half times.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of different things there. You can check it out and, of course, read more about it on the website as well. We're going to have it linked up on redeyesecretions.com. We'll take a short break here. Patrick, stay with us, and we'll be right back with more.
He swivels his head, tears his eyes from the screen. As his past puts him back in Atlantic City, there's not even a demon in heaven or hell. Is it all just human disguise as I walk down the aisle? And I'm gone, now I'm older than movies. And I know who's there when silhouettes fall. And I'm gone, like I'm dancing on angels. And I'm gone, through the cracks in the past, like a dead man walking. Like a dead man walking. Three old men dancing under the lamplight, shaking their sex and bones and the boys that we were. An alien nation in therapy, sliding naked and nude, like a bad-tempered child on the rain-slick streets. And I'm gone, now I'm older than movies. And I know who's there when silhouettes fall. And I'm gone, like I'm dancing on angels. And I'm gone, through the crack in the past, like a dead man walking. Like a dead man walking. Dead man. Dead man. Dead man.
To proceed with more and get into some fringe aspects of Patrick's life and work next. But before we do that, I just want to mention that on Red Ice Radio, we have Rupert Sheldrake with us next for a shorter After Christmas Before New Year program. I guess this could be seen as our attempt at something of a break of sorts, but We're going to keep on providing investigations into research and claims on all the topics that we find interesting and intriguing, no matter what time of year. In the next hour with Patrick Flanagan, we are going to continue to talk about his book Pyramid Power and the positive effects of golden ratio architecture on the human body versus negative sound resonant buildings. He also talks about his Hansa water research and the amazing benefits of negative ionized hydrogen. Then Patrick talks about his suggestion that he might be the reincarnated Nikola Tesla. We'll ask more about that. Later we discuss what kind of technology the government is using, including mind control technologies and projected thought machines. We discuss how Patrick's neurophone can actually be used for sinister means. And we end on the whole 2012 thing, the 100th monkey effect and incoming energies from the center of the universe. RedIceMembers.com is where you can acquire a membership and continue to listen to our second hour with Patrick Flanagan and all our previous programs. All right, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Stay with us.